Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. U.S. forces are continuing their investigation into the crash of an American helicopter in Afghanistan on Saturday. 30 American troops were killed, the largest one-day loss of life since the war began. Joining me to talk about the tragedy and its potential impact on U.S. policy in Afghanistan, Tom Shanker. He's Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. Paul Pillar of the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, joining us by phone from Plymouth, Massachusetts, Anthony O'Brien. He's former Navy SEAL Lieutenant Commander, and we will be taking your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane.
Tom Shanker, if I could start with you, give us an update on the investigation.
Right, of course. Always an honor to be on your show, Diane.
Thank you.
The investigation was really slowed initially. This is a very rugged part of Afghanistan. And after a catastrophe like this, from a very large vehicle and a lot of people, just removing the pieces and clearing the site, both to show dignity to those who passed and for investigative purposes, really took a lot of time. So the investigation is really moving into its serious phase today, even as we speak. It appears pretty certain that it was a rocket-propelled grenade that brought it down. The military is calling it a lucky shot. These helicopters fly all over Afghanistan, but the Chinook is large, and while it's very quick and can carry a lot of troops, in landing and taking off, it's slow and loud and hot.
And it becomes thereby an easy target.
That's right. Even at night when these missions are carried out, that's why they're called the night raids, these helicopters are silhouetted against the sky. The powerful engines glow. And also when you think about a helicopter descending or ascending in a valley, even though it may be safe, if an insurgent or a militant is on the side of that valley, well, he comes just sort of eye to eye with the pilot at some point during the mission. That appears to be what happened here, although the investigation is still underway.
Was this mission at all out of the ordinary?
Not at all. There are questions already being raised about why one of the most elite SEAL counterterrorism units was sent on this mission. But nonetheless, there was a group of Rangers on the ground going after the leader of a militant IED in attack cell. They got in trouble. They called for help. That's what the SEALs do. But this is what they do. Many times a night, I did some reporting after the successful SEAL mission that killed Osama bin Laden. That got all the publicity. But on the Afghan side of the border, that very night, there were 24 other counterterrorism missions going on. So the pace, the tempo of these raids, Diane, are sort of unimaginable. They're kept in the secret, of course. So this was not unusual at all. It was just a very unusual and tragic ending.
Tom Shanker, he is a reporter for the New York Times and author of the forthcoming book, Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Do join us, 800-433-8850. And to you, Anthony O'Brien, I'd be interested in your response to the questions now being raised about whether this particular target merited risking so many of our elite troops.
Well, it's an interesting question, and good morning to Tom and Paul and Mr. Secretary as well. It's an interesting question. I don't want to second guess the commanders on the ground. Certainly, if you've got a unit that's pinned down and they need some help, I'm going to guess that the reason why they would bring in an asset like the Navy SEALs is because it was a very dangerous and risky mission, and they needed some urgent help. They were available in the area, and so I'm not going to second guess what the commanders are deciding on the ground. For that particular operation, obviously we have to take the good with the bad. The Afghanis have shown to be, for many, many decades, if not longer, to be very formidable opponents, and they're not going to give up their country. And certainly when you add the recent Taliban element to it as well, it complicates things quite a bit. I'm not on active duty anymore, so my questions are more for our administration and issues like, is this winnable? What are our objectives? What's the plan locally, regionally, the measurables, the end state? Obviously, now that I'm retired, I can ask those questions that I couldn't ask publicly with regards to our policies there.
Anthony O'Brien, former Navy SEAL Lieutenant Commander, turning to you, Paul Pillar, is this incident, in your mind, likely to affect the pace of operations by the SEALs, either to increase or decrease their activities?
No, I don't think it will. This is on its own right, a highly significant event. 30 of our very brave warriors lost their lives along with 8 Afghans, and we need to reflect on the sacrifice that they and their loved ones have made here. But in terms of the operational strategy, and more specifically the pace and amount of operations by the SEALs, no, it will not affect it. As Tom described, the hazards have been well known for quite some time with these hellebore operations. The Pentagon spokesman described this as a one-off that would not affect decisions about continuing to conduct these operations, and I expect that will be the case.
What about the Ranger team that was in place that these SEALs and others were going to rescue, Tom Shanker?
The details are still emerging, but it appears to have been a mission by the Rangers, who are the elite light infantry, also part of the special operations community, going after an insurgent leader in the Tangi Valley of Wardak province. It's a very hostile area west of Kabul. His network, his cell, had been responsible for a number of IEDs and for a number of attacks on coalition forces. They were trying to expand the militant territory, take ground, and so the decision was made to go after him. And that Ranger group apparently got into a little trouble, although all of them successfully completed the mission and none of them were killed. But of course, at some point during the fight, they called for a quick reaction force. That was the SEALs and the resulting tragedy.
Can you talk a little bit, Tom, about the overall role of the special forces in Afghanistan?
Right. That's a great question, Diane. They have a continuum of effort. The special forces, normally known as the Green Berets, do a lot of what's called foreign internal defense. They are working with local Afghans to build their capability, the Afghan local police force, those sorts of things, to help the Afghans stand up on their own feet. At the other extreme are the highly kinetic, the highly active, the highly lethal counterterrorism units, like the SEALs, like the Rangers, who really just do the attack piece of the mission. They go after the networks to take out the financiers, the cell leaders, the bomb-making factories, and the elite SEAL unit that did the bin Laden raid, the one that was wiped out in the tragedy on Saturday. They go after high-value targets, the most critically essential targets identified by military intelligence.
So if you were looking at that Team 6 that did go after Osama bin Laden, there were members of Team 6 then aboard this helicopter, not necessarily the same,
That's
who
right.
went after bin Laden. On the other hand, did the insurgents not claim that this was in retaliation for the killing of Osama bin Laden, Paul Pillar.
The likes of the Taliban, as well as terrorist groups, commonly claim whatever they can plausibly claim, or even not so plausibly claim. And I doubt very much that they were aware at the time, including whoever fired the rocket-propelled grenade, exactly who was in that chopper. But after it became known that SEAL Team 6 personnel were involved, the obvious propaganda point for the Taliban to score was to claim, and for others to claim, that this was retaliation for the raid against bin Laden.
What lessons do you think we should draw from this tragedy?
I think the larger issues that Anthony O'Brien correctly mentioned, getting above the questions of trying to second-guess commanders on the ground and operational strategy, but really stepping back and asking what is this doing to help make Americans more secure. It punctuates the costs. It underscores the costs that we have been sustaining when we lose 30 of our finest in one incident. And we have to ask ourselves, is this the kind of cost that we want to continue to sustain in return for what benefit? And given that what we are fighting here is a Taliban that is basically an indigenous guerrilla group, not an international, transnational terrorist group, I think it's appropriate to be skeptical whether or not we had this particular incident with a helicopter about whether this is a cost-effective endeavor.
Anthony O'Brien, do you want to comment?
Yes, I just wanted to add that, those are the questions that actually, as far as my study shows, a majority of Americans have been asking those questions, and not just in the last few months. These are some of the questions actually that were factors that helped the president get elected in 2008. And now, of course, since the surge, it's his operation, and that's fine. But I think that the majority of Americans, in fact, a large majority, are asking these questions. And is it winnable? What are the objectives? What's the plan, the measurables, the end state?
All right. Anthony O'Brien, former Navy SEAL Lieutenant Commander. Short break. We'll be right back. And, of course, we are talking about the tragedy in Afghanistan. On Saturday, 30 American troops were killed, and that was the largest one-day U.S. loss of life since the war began. Here in this studio are Tom Shenker, Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. He's co-author of a new book coming out on Tuesday. It's titled Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Here in the studio also is Paul Pillar. He's director of graduate studies at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. He's a former CIA National Intelligence Officer. On the line with us is Anthony O'Brien, former Navy SEAL, Lieutenant Commander. And joining us now by phone from Lewis, Delaware, is Lawrence Korb. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. Good morning to you, Larry.
Good morning, Diane, and good morning to the rest of your panel.
Tell me, to what extent do you believe the tragedy in Afghanistan last Saturday is going to galvanize public opinion on efforts to withdraw from Afghanistan more quickly?
Well, I think it's going to be almost, and I know no analogy is perfect, but kind of like a Tet moment where people will focus on this. Because up until 2007, Afghanistan had been the forgotten front. But in the last year, particularly as our economic crisis has not seemed to get any better, people have been focusing on it because of the money that we're spending there. And I think Paul mentioned something about it before. We're spending about $2 billion a month, $2 billion a week there. And I think, you had a vote in the House last year. You had 214 members say, let's get out more quickly. And then you had two Democrats and a Republican senator writing an op-ed in the New York Times pretty much saying the same thing. And I think what will happen is people are going to take a look. And if you take a look at where this happened, we used to occupy this. Then we left, even at the height of the surge. And, of course, then we went back in. And that shows even with the top level of the troops that you have now that you can't secure the whole country. And there's no way we're going to be sending more troops.
So, realistically, even if you do not send more troops, how much more quickly do you think withdrawal from Afghanistan could actually be accomplished?
Well, I think the administration is not going to do it. In fact, I was very disappointed yesterday when Secretary of Defense Panetta said, we're there to defeat al-Qaeda. No, we're not. When he was at the CIA, he said there's hardly any of them, left there. And, of course, we've got bin Laden. I think you may see the Congress and maybe even as part of this deficit commission, push, or the deficit super panel, as they call it, push to, cut down more rapidly. The president has talked about getting the troops out by the end of next year. I think you may see that even accelerate. And what I would hope, and many of us have been urging this for a while, we should have started negotiating, get a third party to negotiate with the Taliban when we had our maximum amount of forces there.
Paul Pillar, what do you think about this? As Larry has said, this deficit super panel cutting back on the amounts of money going into the war in Afghanistan, will that hasten our withdrawal?
Well, all these things are obviously connected, and I'm sure the administration, as well as leaders in Congress, are thinking in precisely those terms. One of the unfortunate and almost embarrassing things about budgetary practices we've had over these last several years is the way that the war expenditures, most notably for Iraq, but also for Afghanistan, have not been grouped with the sort of so-called core Pentagon budget, but they've been made a separate item. And so a lot of the debate and discussion about defense expenditures has been well off the mark because they have not taken into account the fact that the war expenditures have been over,
off the books,
basically off the books in terms of core defense spending. So it's a big factor, and I trust and I hope that the super committee will bear this very much in mind as they work their numbers.
Larry Korb, what will we have accomplished when we finally make an exit?
Well, I think, basically we, have made it clear that, al-Qaeda can't come back there. And, of course, we use our bases in Afghanistan to get bin Laden. But in terms of what it will be like for Afghanistan, 10 years from now, I think things will be somewhat better because when we were there as part of this commission that Brahimi and Pickering put together, Brahimi, who's the guy who negotiated the bond agreement, and we met with, a lot of the Taliban leaders, their position is, we want to come back, but we're not going to, quote, be as bad as we were the last time, So I think what you will end up with is kind of an arrangement where, the Taliban will have some control in the southern part of the country. But they're not going to make the mistake of, you know, allowing it to be a haven for Al-Qaeda again, because they know that's what got them driven out the first time.
Tom Shanker.
Yeah, I think, you know, Larry and Paul have perfectly described the geostrategic questions there. I just returned from Afghanistan last Tuesday, and when you talk to commanders on the ground, they're all very, you know, positive and gung-ho, but nobody uses the word victory or success anymore. The new phrase you keep hearing is Afghan good enough. And I think that's what they're looking for to come out of this. And to Paul's very good point about the budget, even though, Diane, we're here to talk about Afghanistan today, I think the American people have to realize that whether the budget cuts are $400 billion or more than that, we are very quickly getting to a point where the American military will not have the money to carry out the strategy on paper today. And no one is beginning to ask the questions, what won't the military do? Where won't it patrol? What parts of the world do we not care about? What parts of our security do we have to push to another day?
Anthony O'Brien, I want to bring you back into this, because the training of SEALs, as I understand it, is some 2 years in the making. Give us an idea of what goes into that training and the cost thereof per person.
Well, yes, ma'am. Of course, your average SEAL is your average American coming out of high school or college from all over the country. They go through a very demanding and challenging course. There are obviously people that seek a challenge and are very patriotic and want to be one of the best of the best. But we also realize that we're only one member of a team. We lost some Army soldiers in that helicopter incident on Saturday, and we need to remember them and the SEALs in our prayers and thoughts. But the amount of training they go through, your timetable is about right, and it's probably whatever X number of thousands of dollars, and that's not to say that that's wasted in any way in a situation like this, because we're going to obviously pick ourselves back up and continue the mission. But again, for me, you know, I like the geopolitical conversation that the Secretary and Tom and Paul are having, because, you know, you look at Afghanistan, and one of the biggest questions I have before I get into any fight, and if the fight is a good fight, tell me where and when, and I'll be there. But the Soviets had tank divisions in that area for over a decade, and they couldn't make a dent, because the Afghanis and that terrain are very, very tough. We have 150,000 folks or so, and a lot of them are on horseback, and it's a very, very challenging area. And again, is it winnable? Is Al-Qaeda not there? The Secretary mentioned that. What about the Taliban? The oppression of women continues, opium, the village chiefs, the president, Karzai himself, is corrupted. And so you've got a multidimensional, complicated problem here. But we've definitely got to start addressing it and start looking at it in bigger terms.
All right. And here's an email from Morgan, who says, first, I want to know if a Stinger missile that the U.S. government handed out to the Taliban in the 1980s brought down this chopper. Do we know the answer, Tom?
We don't know the answer yet. The early indications are that it was a rocket-propelled grenade. The Stinger scenario is out there on the Internet, of course, but there's no evidence pointing in that direction right now.
And Morgan goes on to say, at first, the news report said a rocket-propelled grenade was used, and sounds unlikely. Now, today I read a report stating a more modern weapon was used. Do we know anything about that, Larry Korb?
Well, it's interesting. I was in government when we had this big debate about whether we should have given the Stingers to the Mujahideen, you know, who were then fighting the Soviets. And our military was unanimous against it, because they were afraid these would fall into the wrong hands. So, you know, we don't know. But obviously, if these things are out there, that is a whole different situation, because these are much more lethal than a rocket-propelled grenade.
All right. Larry, can you stay on the line with us?
Sure.
All right. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Traverse City, Michigan. Good morning, Josh. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just had wanted to comment on, and you guys have touched on it somewhat since I got on the line, but just I believe that for President Obama, it's just really critical that he does not make the same mistake that President Bush did with Iraq, and being real with the American people and saying that, you know, we realize this is not what we wanted it to be, and being kind of man enough to say, you know, I was wrong a little bit. And I think that's what hurt President Bush so badly, is everybody saw almost an arrogance that he took us for idiots. You know, we can see what's going on. There's no weapons of mass destruction. The countries aren't ready to change. You just mentioned, you know, their oppression of women and things like that. You know, people and countries, they change when they're ready to change. And I just really think he seems to be making almost the same mistake that President Bush did.
Larry Korb.
Well, I think the call is right now. Obama can't right now look like he's caving into the pressure. But I do think, you know, he has already started his withdrawal. And I think what he needs to do is accelerate that and then appoint a special envoy, not an American, get someone, a Turk, for example, to begin negotiations, how this ends and what kind of situation we're going to leave behind. But I think he's right. The last thing you want to do is say, well, you know, we're going to send more troops, you know, right now.
Paul Pillar.
I agree with Larry's comment. And I just wanted to add, I would question somewhat the parallel that was drawn quite so tightly between the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, because there I think it's fair to say that the Iraq War was a mistake from the beginning, whereas Operation Enduring Freedom, our military intervention into the ongoing Afghanistan Civil War, was, in my view, and I think the view still of most of the American people, a just response back in 2001 to the 9/11 terrorist outrage, which was committed by a group that at that time was resident in Afghanistan as a guest of the Taliban. But 10 years almost have gone by, and the issue is not whether it was a mistake in the first place, but rather how has the mission creeped in such a way that we're now trying to build a democratic society that has never really had one before. So the two wars are really different.
Paul Pillar of Georgetown University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Knoxville, Tennessee. Good morning, Don. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
I just wanted to comment real quick. Anytime you have generals on the air and they're pressured to give some reasons why we're in this war in Afghanistan, they always fall back to a main reason being women's rights, so girls can go to school, for all the Taliban oppression. And I was just wondering if your panelists thought that was really a legitimate reason that we should have our military spending billions of dollars a year in this country to fight for women's rights.
Anthony O'Brien.
I agree with the caller's premise. The primary reason why you engage the military at the strategic level is for the national security interests of the United States of America. And as much as I'm a fighter for the rights of women, it's not our duty in the military primarily to protect women or stop drug trades, etc. However, the president is the boss and he calls the shots. And if whether it be President Bush or President Obama, when they tell us where to go and when, we give a snappy salute and we do what we're told. But fortunately, we can discuss these things after retirement. And that's so it's an honor to be with you to do so.
Thank you, Tom Shanker.
Well, I just wanted to give Anthony a snappy salute because his answer is perfect. I mean, we hear so often these conversations among civilians: why are we there? I don't want us there, or the opposite, we should be there. The military does not assign itself these missions. They follow the orders of the elected civilian leadership who are representing, Diane, your caller, and everybody else. So that is where the responsibility for these decisions resides at the end of the day.
All right, to San Antonio, Texas. Joyce, you're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to ask about the leadership ability, because as a person who has been in leadership for a long time, you never put all your assets on one flight. You never use older technology than those assets are worth. And it sounds like the way we did it made no sense. At least in the business world, we learned not to put a ton of assets in harm's way on one bad technology that could be seen. And that's not even war. This is war.
All right, Larry Korb.
Well, I think that you have to go back to, you know, the point that Tom made. You've got to do, you know, the civilian leaders should do a cost-benefit analysis. And what happened is as Paul mentioned, we went in there after 9/11, which was the right thing to do, but then we just kept on doing it and not thinking about it. And, of course, we diverted our attention to Iraq. Many people argue we could have finished the job back then. We didn't. The Taliban offered to negotiate with Karzai back in 2001, and we said no. The Bush administration said, no, you can't. President Bush used to get these reports on Afghanistan from what we know from, Tom's colleague's book, called the Inheritance, David Sanger's book, and all he would ask about is how many women are going to school. And, obviously that's a good thing that you'd want, but that's not why you're, waging this war. And I think what happened, President Obama during the campaign said, I didn't think Iraq was the right war. We didn't pay attention to Afghanistan, so I'm going to put more troops in there. Well, he did in early 2009, and then, of course, the military said, if you really want to do the job, we need even more. And then, of course, you ended up, basically tripling the number of troops.
But I think, Tom Schenker, our caller is also asking why were so many people on one helicopter.
Right, and it really is a great question, whether as a business model or a tactical question for the military. We don't know enough about the mission. The Chinook helicopter is faster than the Black Hawk. It can carry more people. It can go higher. So it might have been the best piece of equipment for the mission, Diane.
Tom Schenker, The New York Times. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
A look at the evolutionary basis of shyness, possible advantages to being shy, but why treatment is sometimes needed. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We're back talking about the tragedy that occurred on Saturday when a U.S. helicopter carrying some 30 U.S. personnel plus Afghan soldiers and a translator were shot down in Kabul. And President Obama is heading to Dover to view the returning bodies of servicemen killed on Saturday. Here's an email question from Jerry, who says, usually elite teams like SEALs are flown by very special Army aviators. These SEALs were flown by a group of the Kansas National Guard. Why didn't they use the Night Stalkers of the 160th, the ones that flew the Bin Laden mission? I'm sure the Kansas pilot was good, but they are not comparable to the Night Stalker pilots, especially for night direct action missions like these, just seems like the night vision time. They aren't as good. What about that to you, Anthony?
It's a good question. You're starting to get into an area of classified information that makes me a little uncomfortable, so I can't go into too many of the details. But again, we're kind of questioning the tactical level, the commander on the ground, what resources are they using, why are they using them, and if that's appropriate or not. And, you know, unless you're in that person's situation, it's tricky to do that. I mean, I could sit in my living room in Boston and talk about that, but really I think what folks need to focus on is less the tactical level. Trust me, these folks in leadership at the tactical level, they know what they're doing, and 99 times out of 100, they're making great calls. I really think that the higher level of attention needs to be on the policies, as the Secretary said, the cost-benefit analysis of what we're doing over there, what's the threat there, what's the threat here. The Afghanis don't want us there. What they're getting for benefit from us is our money over there. It's so difficult to win a politically correct war. We're trying to do that. And again, I think the key questions are the objectives achievable? Your previous caller had asked about the tactical spread of the forces, the distribution of forces, having so many guys on one aircraft. I think that's a reasonable question and analysis, and might be one of the big lessons learned that comes out of this specific incident.
And we've got another email from Steve, who says, last year, WikiLeaks exposed documents contradicting what we'd heard in the news regarding downed helicopters in Afghanistan. The news said small arms fire brought helicopters down. The leaked documents said heat-seeking Stinger missiles. Is the RPG story another example of this? Larry Korb.
Well, again, we don't know. And of course, you would not want to think if the other side has sophisticated weapons like the Stinger, that completely changes, your ability to send helicopters into lots of areas. And again, we don't know. And that's why I hope this investigation that they have about what happened here, really is forthcoming for the American people.
All right. To Covert, Michigan. Good morning, Bob.
Hi. To comment on the snappy salute that the military only does what the civilian leaders ask them, I think is disingenuous. I'd like to think that Obama would like to be out of there yesterday, but I think he's gotten rolled several times that the military keeps telling him they can get this job done, and I question that premise.
Larry Korb.
Well, I think he raises a good question. Based upon what we know from Bob Woodward's book, they did roll him because after he sent in the initial group, they said, oh, we need a new commander. And then, of course, General McChrystal came in and, asked for more troops. And Obama kept asking for, alternatives and didn't get it. And I think, obviously, then somebody leaked what the military, wanted, and that put Obama in a very difficult political position. So I think he's right. I mean, Tom was right when he was talking about, yes, the military does what they're told, but you got to remember, and I can tell you from personal experience, both having been on active duty and then served in the Pentagon, they're pretty shrewd bureaucrats, and when they want something done, they know how to push all the levers of the American political system, including the media.
Paul Pillar.
I'd agree with all that, but just in fairness to the military command, even if they're not in a Machiavellian sort of way trying to roll our president, military commanders have a mission to perform that is defined in terms of accomplishing a military mission in a theater of operations. So naturally, they are going to take a different perspective. They are going to think in terms of what resources they need to accomplish that mission. And it is not their job, certainly not their primary job, to ask those same tough questions that Anthony O'Brien was raising about the larger policy issues and to what purpose are we doing all this. So even if we don't have generals trying to roll the president, they're always going to naturally, by virtue of their mission and their job, take a different point of view.
Larry.
Can I make a comment on that?
Sure. Go ahead, Anthony.
I like the question. I like the challenge, and the gentleman's correct. The military does what it's told, and the military advises the president, and they're going to do so because they know what's going on the ground. But honestly, the military leaders in the military, they want to stay there and take increase the chance of accomplishing their mission as much as possible. But dare I say, we're 40-something minutes into this discussion, and it's been wonderful. And you know, I don't think I've heard the word Vietnam yet. And I just said it. But the thing is that at some point, the civilian leadership, the administration, in the DOD, at the secretary level, at some point, they've got to take a step back, no matter what the military is telling them is on the ground, and say, policy-wise, national security interest-wise, is this the wisest way for us to continue to go, look at the cost benefits, and so that's what the civilian leadership needs to do. And that's not to waffle on what the military is doing, but as the former president said, the buck stops there.
All right, let's hear from a Vietnam vet. Good morning, Randy. Hey, Randy, are you there?
Diane, I'm here.
Go right ahead.
I beg your pardon?
Go right ahead.
Diane, I was in Vietnam early on in the 65-67 era. There was nobody in the Mekong Delta except the 25th Division. I had several experiences with almost the identical thing that's going on, even with the load that was on the Huey, on the Chinook. Diane, listen. Right away, I was transformed back to Vietnam in a flashback. And one thing I have to tell you that I'm concerned about also, as are the people there that are there, other NCOs and the Lieutenant Diane, I'm concerned about the unit they were from and the effect that it had on the troops in Afghanistan.
Any comment, Paul?
Well, speaking as another Vietnam veteran who caught not the beginning of the war but the end of the war, I was there in 1972 and 73 doing a job that mainly involved transporting American GIs back home. And so I saw part of what it did do, what that war did to the American military. The principal bit of processing we had to do before sending these folks back home was a drug test to identify the disturbingly large number of heroin users who by that time, we're talking about 1972-73, had emerged in the ranks of the American Army. It was a very large toll that war took on the Army and the other services themselves, let alone to the rest of American interests and everything else we know about the Vietnam War.
Tom Shanker.
To the caller, a very good question about how this tragedy will affect the unit itself. I've spent the last several days talking to a lot of people from the SOF community, and likewise, after the bin Laden raid, a lot of special operators, Diane, were very uncomfortable with the fist-pumping and chest-pounding after bin Laden was killed. It was a supreme tactical success. They were proud of it, but they like to operate in the shadows. Mm. Likewise, after this tragedy, they will, you know, come around each other and comfort each other, but to them, the mission continues. They will keep doing whatever it is the civilian leadership tells them to do. I don't think there's going to be a morale problem.
Thanks for calling, Randy. Let's go to Fort Worth, Texas. Augustine, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
One of the biggest mistakes we have is that we try to solve ideological, cultural, inter-tribal conflicts with military means, and that's really wrong. We don't have two choices now. We can gather all the intelligentsia, all the intelligent people from Afghani, American descent, and explain to them that they have a moral obligation to fix their own country and provide them the tools for advanced development, resources, recovery, education, social suggestions. We're going to change the structure and see if they will be interested in helping their own country. That's one thing. And the other one is simply to understand that if that is not achieved, eventually they're going to have a whole civil war that is maybe long overdue. And if it's going to happen, we cannot control that.
Larry Korb.
Well, I think Augustine is right. Eventually, the future of Afghanistan is going to have to be decided by the people there. I mean, we can't stay forever. We're supposedly going to turn over, you know, the military mission in 2014, and right now we're negotiating a strategic framework agreement with the Karzai government to see how long, you know, we will stay and under what terms. And I think we need to recognize that. On the other hand, I think it's important, you know, we do have a moral responsibility. We've gone in, you know, for better or worse, we've been there a long time and we're doing these things to do the best that we can to give the Afghans, you know, the opportunity to, you know, live a life that, you know, is free from continuing violence and civil war.
And to Kingston, New York. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Diane. The comment I'd like to make is the Taliban aren't going anyplace. Even Winston Churchill, in his journal in the India War, talks about fighting the Taliban. Unless we can convert these people, this is a very strong religious belief. They feel they're fighting for God, and they're not going anyplace, and they know that we are. So it's time to go.
Phil Pillar.
It's quite right. They're not going anywhere, and it's their country, not ours, that is the subject of the fight. I would just modify a bit what Jim said in pointing out that many of what we call Taliban, those who have taken up arms against the coalition, are not necessarily strongly religiously motivated. They are motivated more by being upset about a foreign occupation, about the damage being done by the war. We've seen the ranks of the Taliban increase, not decrease, over the last several years, which is an unfortunate pattern, but that is a reaction to part of what we are doing. It illustrates some of the counterproductive nature of what we are doing. But the basic point that it's their country, no matter how long we stay there, they're not going to go away, is quite correct.
And here's an email from Michael in San Antonio. He's retired after 20 years in the U.S. Air Force. He says, everyone knows it's impossible to win the war in Afghanistan, but nobody wants to lose face by admitting it. We'd have a better chance of colonizing the moon than winning this war. Afghanistan is just a meat grinder. We keep feeding our young people into it. Bin Laden is dead. Let's get out. Do you agree with those sentiments, Larry Korb?
Well, I think Michael has a good point, and that's why I was upset with, you know, Secretary Panetta saying, well, we're there to fight al-Qaeda. We have basically neutralized, you know, al-Qaeda. And the other thing is, if we set the timetable to leave, then our military forces can leave with dignity. But if we keep hanging around, then it looks like, you know, brave people like Commander O'Brien and these other people, they have not, you know, done their job. They've done their job. So I think that's why we need to take control. The president and the Congress need to take control of the situation.
What do you think, Paul Pillar?
Oh, I quite agree. I would.
Do you think it's time to get out?
Well, basic point I would make, Diane, is that the whole idea of losing face by getting out without having a victory, and that this would damage U.S. interests to a large degree, is overplayed. You know, that is not the way other governments, other adversaries of ours, form their perceptions of us. There was a lot said about that after the Vietnam War. And there was a period in which we kind of sulked in our post-Vietnam syndrome. But it wasn't a matter of other countries saying, oh, the United States is not going to uphold their central interest, their core national interest, because they shed a peripheral one. And I think the same thing is true in Afghanistan. What we face here, what President Obama faces, is a graceful way of exiting, using the sort of terms that Tom mentioned before, you know, good enough, not trying to declare victory, because it's going to be hard to do. I think the biggest peg we've had to hang a graceful exit on has been the killing of bin Laden. You know, not that should have made a big difference in our Afghan strategy, but in terms of selling the idea that we've done our job. This was initially all about al-Qaeda and responding to 9/11. That's probably the best possible opportunity to start the process. And I think that's basically what the president's trying to do.
Anthony, as a former Navy SEAL, how do you respond? Would you get...
I have to agree with the caller's premise, and as well as with Paul's point that it's not about losing face. That almost sounds like a political angle, kind of like again when the civilian leadership decided that we needed to to leave Vietnam. Again, whatever fight you're going to get into, whatever the fight is, one of your first questions has got to be, is it winnable? And history in Afghanistan will show that very difficult to win a fight there, and especially if you're going to do it politically correct. That's my view.
Larry Korb.
Well, I quite agree that with Paul that we did overstate the Vietnam type of thing. I think the great irony is right now we're doing joint exercises with the Vietnamese because of the Chinese aggression in the South China Sea, and I think we need to keep that in mind, that this is not some sort of apocalyptic scenario, which some people will paint it as. I mean, there are still people saying when I worked for Reagan we got out of Lebanon, well that led to 9/11. No, well we would still be in Lebanon trying to straighten that situation out.
And finally, to you, I wonder, Tom Shenker, whether you think the senior level of the Department of Defense and the White House are now thinking more in terms of timing to get out.
Well, the public statements are all about stay the course, see the mission through. Remember, they're on a very dramatic reduction, 10,000 by the end of the year, another 23,000 by next September, everybody out by 2014, Diane.
Tom Shenker of the New York Times, co-author of the new book titled Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Paul Piller of Georgetown University. Anthony O'Brien, former Navy SEAL Lieutenant Commander, and Lawrence Korb of the Center for American Progress. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.